Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast, I talk about what it was like to be in Ireland over the abortion referendum weekend.
And we talk in great, great length about the use and abuse of referenda.
I'm kind of against them. Stephen's kind of for them. Who will win? There's only one way to find out, and that's listening to us talk about it for quite some time. So, Stephen, I am just back from Dublin, where I've been over the weekend covering the Irish referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, which is now going to lead to a much more liberal abortion regime. The Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, is bringing in legislation, hopefully by the end of the year. I have to say it was incredible. So there was all this sort of stuff beforehand, and Varadkar himself had said, you know, we won't be triumphalist about it. I don't want any kind of celebrations. But actually the mood really kind of was celebratory. I was in Dublin Castle when they announced results, and they didn't have a big screen like they did with the gay marriage result. But people were just gathering there because it meant something really special to them, right? It just meant that, and the campaign was so well directed that it really felt like actually what we were celebrating was the end of a lot of misery for women. And that's something that I think people really did feel that they could celebrate. What did it feel like from you watching it this end of the telescope?
Obviously, I feel like we cover walls going up quite a lot at the moment. It was just quite inspiring. I mean, as with, and however limited the brief accord between North and South Korea proves to be, it just felt quite uplifting as a moment, partly because it actually was, despite all of the kind of talk about the two islands, it was a unifying result, as with the equal marriage result. It was a kind of, and so it kind of felt very beautiful and inspiring.
I think that's one of the things that struck me when I talked to people who've been out canvassing, is that I'd brought all my prejudices along from Brexit, right? And so they said, well, actually, when we've been out canvassing in rural areas, it's not been that much. It's not, because there was a lot of talk about, you know, it needs Dublin to carry this, right? And if you look at the 1983 referendum that brought in the Eighth Amendment, I think the only place that was against bringing it in was a couple of places in South Dublin. But the kind of the map is flipped entirely. So this time Donegal was the only county that voted against. And that's, you know, that's a very poor county, one that has very poor transport links with the capital. It's one where, you know, lots of the younger people have had to leave to find work, for example. All of those things that you would kind of say about kind of British seaside towns or that were quite Brexity. But, you know, to see other, you know, lots and lots of other places that were also voting like 59% in favour that you wouldn't necessarily have expected beforehand. And I think even the campaigners themselves had not really expected the kind of the scale of the victory. I think it was really interesting to me because of what it told me about how you do politics, right, in a couple of different ways. And the first is about the way that they had the Constitutional Convention in 2012, and then they had this Citizens' Assembly in 2016, where they actually had made a point of having these issues that are big social issues, but ones that are really divisive and very much conscience issues, really aired. They heard all the evidence, you know, people were properly involved in the debate. And, you know, it was absolutely everywhere in Dublin and in some of the surrounds of Dublin that I went to. You know, every lamppost had like three posters on it. The number of people you saw with badges on, you know, the people were handing out stickers at the railway stations. And I know your island's a much smaller country, population, I think 4.5 million, but it was a properly educated vote, right? I think, and a properly engaged vote.
The interesting thing is, so obviously you wrote a kind of piece about what people can learn, campaigners can learn from it. And obviously there are always lessons from winning campaigns, and indeed lessons from defeated campaigns, which don't necessarily do everything badly. I think the interesting thing, kind of from a distance, you know, from here in my desk, is that actually not my desk because we're in our temporary podcast room this week, feels a bit than one of the interesting differences between this referendum, the Brexit referendum, but something it shares with the Scottish independence referendum, is actually having that longer run-up. And while I think referenda are, to put it mildly, a suboptimal way of deciding human rights issues, particularly minority issues, and actually I think that holds regardless of whether or not you think life begins at conception or not, because yeah. However, whatever you believe, whatever side you are of the repeal question, you ultimately have a situation in which a majority is voting on the rights of a minority.
But that's an interesting point in itself about the minority point, because Varadkar came out on the day of the vote and said, I want to say to the no campaigners, you haven't woken up in a completely different country. This is still the Ireland, it's just a bit more open and inclusive than it was before. And I think the contrast between that and David Cameron, well, I can't even really remember what David Cameron said in that, apart from like, bye, I'm off, smell you later speech. But just the kind of effort to be reassuring to people that they were still respected and their opinion was still respected, rather than the sort of jeering that I felt characterised the aftermath and the EU referendum.
Well, I think, obviously later on we're going to have a fight about whether or not referenda are, in general, a useful tool or not. I quite like them for some things. I think the problem is, from a governance perspective, governments should not hold referenda where they do not support the change proposition, because there is no one who can really act as the unifying figure to reassure the losing side that it's okay if the government, no one
is
else
the losing side.
If the government is the losing side, and particularly when you don't have in the United Kingdom a president who is mostly non-political but has some mandate to come out and go.
Yes, it's not like the Queen can come out afterwards and say, aren't we all coming together? Because that's just not what she does at all.
So there's no lever to kind of reunify when the government doesn't support the change proposition. Whereas, there are a variety of reasons why the AV referendum was less acrimonious and less of an event in British public life than the Brexit vote was, or the Scottish independence vote was. But if that had passed, then Nick Clegg is then empowered and has a kind of constitutional role which would allow him to go, don't worry, you haven't.
Don't worry,
we
slightly changed the voting system, but it'll be like the sky hasn't fallen in. Yeah.
And it is also partly about the difference between the temperament of Varadkar and of Cameron. I don't think that people in the Scottish Labour and Scottish Liberal Democrat parties are right to put as much weight upon Cameron's speech the morning of the referendum in terms of how well the SNP did in 2015. If you look at how well the Bloc did after the first referendum in
Quebec. Do you mean when he came out and started talking about English votes for English laws?
Yeah, he basically kind of, Thursday evening, babe, don't leave. Friday morning, I'll put the spoons in whatever damn drawer I like. Obviously, that didn't help. However, I think the blame it gets for the kind of the politics of post-referendum Scotland is slightly overstated, but it definitely did contribute.
But that's the thing, is that, covering this, and quite unashamedly, obviously had to bring my own perspective to it. There's obviously Irish writers who've written about it much better than I have, having been involved in the process throughout. But to see the difference between the way that the EU referendum was both prosecuted and then what followed it, and this, was just absolutely astonishing to me. Can I say something else in the secrecy of the podcast room, which is I was really impressed by the number of men at campaigning for Yes. But most of all, I was really impressed by the fact that they appeared to be actually campaigning for Yes rather than trying to be in charge of the campaign for Yes. And I think that's really, really telling, because when you're doing, and it wasn't really presented as a feminist campaign per se, if you see what I mean. Like, it wasn't presented as a kind of exclusionary campaign in any sense, right? It was very much always trying to be about, like, bringing as many people together as possible and building a kind of coalition, which I think you can do much more easily when you're unified around one quite narrow proposition. Like, I've obviously, in the research of my book, been working on researching the stuff around the vote and the way the suffragettes, who came from different classes, some of them went full fash in the 30s. Some of them went to become communists and anarchists. And actually what you can do when you all just want one very narrow thing is put that aside because you have one political priority. But the campaign was, it felt very, very broad and like across age groups as well. And I think that's something, I mean, I've written in a piece about it in the New European this week, but I don't, again, it's like the thing of blaming Cameron. I don't blame the Remain campaign particularly for running a very narrow economy-based argument, because with the length of campaign that they had to do, they just didn't have time to do any education about, are you really sure you want to leave Galileo? Are you really sure you want to like put radiotherapy drugs in danger? Are you really sure about the Irish border? But it's kind of unavoidable that it was just not, lots of things were not aired as well as they could have been, right?
Yeah, and let's park the referendum issue for part two, and let's instead discuss
Northern Ireland. So one of the signs, when I went to Dublin Castle on Saturday afternoon, people gathered in the courtyard, you know, a couple of hundred people there. One of the signs that someone was holding up was one, apart from one that said, I fancy Simon Harris, who is the Irish health minister, who's had a bit of a kind of Damascene conversion on this stuff. Another one that just said, the North is next. And actually in the research for my book, again, sorry, not to keep plugging the book, but it slightly looms quite large in my mind. I went over to talk to some Northern Irish abortion activists about what's going on there. And the thing that I hadn't really clocked until that point is, so the 1967 Abortion Act that was brought in Britain, what it did is essentially carved out exemptions from the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act, which has the offence of essentially procuring an abortion or procuring an noxious substance for the purpose of having an abortion, and says, look, under these circumstances, actually, this is all okay. And you have to have the signatures of two doctors and then stuff about licensed premises happening and all this kind of stuff, which was the kind of trade-off for getting at what is, you know, globally quite a long time limit of 24 weeks. But the problem with that is that that 1967 Act was never implemented in Northern Ireland. And actually, weirdly, you've now got a situation where all the bits of the UK have got quite different regimes. So in Scotland, for example, they changed the licensing on the drugs that are used for early abortions so that you can take those at home. And they've just gone ahead and kind of done that. You know, now we've got a situation, thanks to Stella Creasy and her amendment last year, where Northern Irish women can travel to England and get paid for on NHS England. And that was always something that was in the Irish constitution as well. The right to travel was protected, which is one of the big arguments that they made about the fact that, you know, people say there's no abortion in Ireland. Well, there is actually. It's codified into our constitution that we've exported this issue to our next door country. So the battle now moves to the idea about whether or not it's instalments power, really, this legislation, which it doesn't have to be if the focus is on the 1861 law, right?
Well, yeah.
I'm repeating that.
So there are a couple of undercurrents. I agree. So after the Scottish referendum, Angela Eagle effectively fought a one-woman fight to prevent abortion law being further devolved as part of the extra powers, which basically...
Yeah, I remember that.
And I essentially agree with her argument. She banged her fists on the table. I know this isn't been briefed by people to make her look good, because the person who briefed it to me went, this demented woman did this. And I kind of did that thing I always do when someone briefs something to me where I don't agree with them, which is go, how interesting. But she's right. Human rights should not be devolved, right? Regardless, and I think regardless of whether or not you think Scotland would be better off independent, it is suboptimal while you do have a political union to have human rights here, human rights there, and different levels of human rights in various places. Also, crucially, Stormont is mothballed. It looks highly unlikely to be unmothballed anytime soon. Now, of course, the problem is the government really doesn't want to admit that direct rule is back.
Yeah.
Partly because...
Well, it's got all this stuff going on with civil servants trying to make decisions and then getting kind of judicial reviews against them, yeah. Right? Because, so, like, who is minding the shop if there's no government, we're not having direct rule, and civil servants aren't really empowered to keep it ticking over, is all a very fraught question.
Yeah, and obviously one of the things that podcast listeners will be aware of just from these episodes, and people who read my free morning email will be aware of, and people who get the bonus email,
subscriber,
for people who are
only
behind the paywall, yeah, and looks at the week ahead, will be aware of, isn't the government's agenda is not so much thin as essentially non-existent. Now, one of the reasons is the parliamentary majority, but the other is that most of the big departments are just in this kind of Brexit fog of having to do quite so much of. So the kind of second you go, by the way, some ministers are going to have to start running Northern Ireland, at that point, the question is, does the ship of state just keel over? And so it's partly with Theresa May's reluctance to acknowledge the existence of of the fact that the direct rule is happening. It is secondly, I think, and this is in, you know, this is speculation, or but it feels to me, so one, there have been two interesting trends in the Conservative Party, that while it has become more liberal on equal marriage, it has actually become more anti-choice.
I think that's really interesting and relatively unremarked on. So one of the Tory vice chairs, Maria Caulfield, is one of a big proponent of reducing the time limit. And there's several people in, well, Maria Miller has in the past, you know, she's chair of the Women and Equalities Committee, is someone who would probably back reducing the time limits. Nadine Dorris has obviously been. I forgot Fiona from the Tory backbenchers, who brought in the sex selective amendment last year, which was a kind of backdoor restriction on abortions.
That I know who you mean. Fiona Bruce.
Fiona Bruce, who I always get confused with because she's not the one that does Antiques Roadshow.
Oh, so I always get confused because for a long time you had Fiona Bruce, fairly big into restricting reproductive rights, and Fiona McTaggart, very big into extending reproductive rights, really hot on domestic violence as a political issue. And obviously, there is nothing more stressful than when you're writing about
Fiona's,
knowing than fundamentally getting the wrong Fiona.
This could not be a more wrong Fiona. Yeah. This is a bit like the Heidi Alexander, Heidi Allen point, in which you just thought, there's always a...
Breathe the sigh of relief when one of the Heidis left.
Yeah, you've got Heidi Al, and then really, under a stress condition on live television, are you always 100% going to get the right one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. But then, so that's... And actually, Yvette Cooper was really instrumental in fighting back against that. But it was, you know, there's lots of these little chips kind of coming at it. Jeremy Hunt is, I'm pretty sure, a pro-lifer, I think, because his Christian background. I think he's somebody who said his personal opinion is that it should be lower, but, you know, he's not kind of wildly agitating about it. So I think there is a kind of, yeah, there is a, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg obviously is a massive fan of children and people having children.
Yeah, and so for a variety of reasons, it is a fairly painful issue to reopen for the Conservative Party, partly because obviously the country is very much going in the opposite trajectory.
Well, Northern Ireland, I think the polling that was looking at there was that the numbers were not dissimilar to the final results in the Irish referendum.
Yeah.
So the public opinion there is definitely, it's not like this would be kind of crazy liberal England or Westminster imposing its kind of metropolitan elite values on people who didn't want them in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, although, and again, to slightly, obviously we'll have our referendum rammy in a bit, but I did think, so another person who's been very instrumental in the cross-party alliance to defend reproductive rights, along with Yvette Cooper, Harriet Harman and people like that on the Labour side, is Sarah Wollaston, who I have a great deal of time for, but I do not understand why she was like, have a referendum on abortion in Northern Ireland was something she said. One thing she suggests, she said, at least have a referendum on Twitter. Unite have also called for a referendum.
That's cuckoo. Because yeah. All that would do is, the only thing you could hope for from that is that it would give you such a sort of overwhelming mandate that Arlene Foster would have to kind of go, okay, well, it turns out 70% or whatever it is, 65%, 60% want it. But she's not going to do that. I mean, she already knows that there's a majority from the polling, but she's not, you know, her job is to be leader of the DUP, and that's where her party is.
But also, it's just... Yeah,
I mean, also, it's fundamentally unnecessary, yeah, right? Yeah, because it's also, not, they yeah. don't have a written constitution which needs referendums to repeal it.
But also, and this may be part of my continual effort to find Venn diagrams in which I'm the only one in the middle bit of the circle, but as someone who was unhappy with the result of the 2016 Brexit referendum and happy with the result of this referendum, ultimately, Brexit is an issue far more suited to referenda than rights issues. It's just a really... no group should have to appeal to another for its rights. And again, I do think that does hold, regardless of whether or not... Now, from a scientific perspective, I'm sorry, I simply do not buy the pro-life argument. But if you do, again, I just don't see how, from a rights perspective, it can be appropriate for either fetuses or women to have to appeal to another group for their... in a plebiscite for their rights. That just... This is not a good road to go down in my view.
No, and I think it's something that's, generally I think this is an issue that probably if people aren't massively or haven't been massively aware of it until now is a very good time to get interested in it, because some of the stuff that America is doing, obviously Trump immediately brought back in the global gag rule, which prevents American-funded NGOs from kind of talking about abortion, which is as is traditional for Republican presidents. But, you know, I think, you know, Mike Pence is an evangelical Christian. He's very, comes very much from that pro-life tradition. There are already restrictions going up. I mean, the way that's always happened in America is it's always treated as a kind of ongoing running wedge issue, right? In the way it doesn't actually, I don't think the GOP really wants it to be settled forever because it's so useful to them as a kind of rallying call. But what they do is they just keep putting restrictions in. You keep, you know, asking for, you know, you have to have a transvaginal ultrasound, you have to see the heartbeat on a thing, you know, you have to do this before, all these hurdles that you have to jump, constantly chipping away at provision. And I think, you know, Poland has also got restrictive law. You know, I mean, Poland's going in a pretty, I would say, a liberal direction generally. And this is one evidence for it. And I think that we're going to see a return of natalism across some of the more illiberal parts of the world, and like, and in Eastern Europe too, because already it's such a big far right meme about, you know, white, you know, white women aren't fulfilling their kind of reproductive duties. That sort of weird anxiety that's all wrapped into that kind of masculinist anger in the far right. But this is, yeah, I think this is an issue that we're probably going to, I hope that we're going to hear a lot more about in a positive direction. But certainly we will hear a lot more about it in one direction or another.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
Yeah. And the question we've been getting is basically, well, referendums, what are they good for?
Well, except it's never been phrased like that, is it? It's always phrased in a kind of gotcha where it's like, oh, if you like referendums, why don't you just gay marry one? Like, it's got that kind of sort of like, so like, you like them when they deliver the result you want. It's like, yeah, I'm also much happier the day after a general election that delivers the result I want. Is that, like, it's not like you go, oh, I see, you think elections are good now.
Yeah, but so the thing, I mean, there are many things I find irksome about that. What I always think of as the why are the Lib Dems celebrating winning in a first-pass election hypocrites gambit. I find it irksome because I think one of the most annoying things in public life is people pretending to be stupider than they are.
It's also quite annoying when people are really stupid.
But the other annoying thing is actually from a kind of, to put my constitutional nerd hat on.
Do you ever take that hat off, Stephen? Let's be honest here.
Yeah, good point. To straighten my constitutional nerd hat, actually the role and utility of referenda is actually quite an interesting question. And it's kind of a bit annoying that, you know, particularly when they are people who are notionally, as far as I can tell, meant to be serious academics, when quite an interesting debate, they kind of immediately come and take a dump in the pool, as it were. Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where it's just like, I mean, could you just not? Yeah, because
there was an absolutely magnificent exchange on Twitter on the day of the 8th referendum between a commentator who shall remain unnamed, who did a sort of like, isn't it weird that like women want abortion, feminists want abortions, yet they'll wear like baby on board signs on the bus? Like, don't they? So why do they think they're babies now, but sometimes they insist on them being called fetuses? And I think it was Dara O'Brien who just went like, look, the Irish have been talking about this for years. Don't come along on the final day and insert your sixth form debating points into this. And I was just like, that's sort of a bit how I feel about that gotcha referendum point. You know, this was a massive day for women who'd spent months talking about, you know, often about their painful personal experiences. Lots of people who talked about, you know, having a fatal fetal abnormality, you know, the idea that they found a baby they really wanted and they found it, you know, actually it's only got a brain stem. Like, this baby is never going to be able to take a breath. And what do you do in that circumstance? And coming out and telling those stories. And then someone wanders up to go like, excuse me, but I've got some prejudices I'd like to air to make me seem clever. It's just extremely annoying.
Yeah.
But our referendum's good now.
So I think referenda in general are a useful tool in some circumstances, right? And I actually think, you know, kind of to air the opinion will have caused half our listeners to turn off in disgust again. So I actually think that Britain's relationship with the European Union is a good topic for a referenda because the essential trade-off, right, is you sacrifice a considerable amount of sovereignty in order to achieve a variety of aims that, in my view, you cannot achieve as a single unit, and to have a massive trade dividend. And actually, that trade-off between, well, that trade-off, that different trade-off between where you lose your sovereignty and how, is an important topic that, if you're going to have a referendum for, seems like quite a useful time to have one. There are many things which we can get into about the conduct and holding of the 2016 referendum which were suboptimal.
I think the two things that are most obvious about that is the timing. So is the first of all, the kind of David Cameron's like, "Wait, I've won my general election. I didn't expect to. Like, let's get this cracking out of the way and then I can get on with some old Cameroning," you know. And I think that just did not allow the time for anybody to properly have any discussion beforehand. You know, although I take the point that I think that the very pro-Brexit printed press wouldn't have wanted to have any of those conversations anyway. Like, if you had to pick between trade deals and the Good Friday Agreement, which one would you pick? Was never going to be something they would really have wanted to touch. But yeah, and then compounded by then, the, as we said at the time, the madness of triggering Article 50 before you even knew, like, where, you know, being able to tell your ass from your elbow, basically.
Yeah.
So I maybe there is a good Brexit referendum. There could have been a good Brexit referendum. This very definitely was not it.
Well, yeah, because I think, although it is easy and indeed fun to mock pro-Brexit commentators when they go, "Oh, this isn't the Brexit I wanted," and although I don't really believe that you could do Brexit well, the circumstances of a government which didn't support it, which didn't therefore have a white paper, et cetera, hold, you know, just the variety of things that the government did not do in the run-up to the referendum outcome certainly make getting a positive outcome at the end of Brexit harder. However, the referendum in Ireland has just happened, and indeed the referenda on equal marriage, I think are both suboptimal uses of referenda, because I don't think referenda are an appropriate way to decide.
So your point is rights issues.
Yeah.
My problem is that I think that they just, in a first past the post majoritarian parliamentary system, I think they just jam, they are kind of the turd in the pool. Not that this is like the theme of this episode, but I think that they are, and everyone sort of has to swim around them. Who's going to get the net? You know, I just think they, you know, you're never going to get the pool really clean again.
Well, so Tom Harris's point, which I'm not unsympathetic to, is that they are most effective when they are used to prove something that we kind of know about public opinion already. So in the case of the devolved parliaments in 99, we knew that it was the settled will of Scottish people to have a devolved parliament. And actually, the referendum was really just about confirming something that was widely
known. Yeah, giving
us
a sort of stamp to that. Yeah, I can see the point of that.
But
crucially, that was also a referendum where the two things that were going to happen in either event of either outcome were very clear. Maybe that's the key point to referenda that you need to understand, because either you don't have a Scottish Parliament or you do, and like that's you, and people can go, okay, I know what each of those things means.
But in terms of, say, Scottish independence, right? The final destination of independent Scotland is by definition unknowable. However, from a self-determination perspective, I cannot work out a more effective way of gauging that than a referendum. Now,
but also, by voting yes in that, you're saying that Scottish independence is more important to you than any of the other little quibbles that might be along the way about the use of sterling, like about the Queen, all that kind of stuff.
And although
you're saying that the thing that you want most and you're prepared to sacrifice stuff for. But I think that's the point about that's different again from the EU, is about what you're, when you say leave the EU, what exactly you mean by which of the many superstructures and multinational agreements.
Well, this
agreements
is why it comes back
mean
to the fact that there was a white paper in the Scottish independence referendum. Mm. There were many assumptions in it, and I think were slightly heroic. But
it was a huge, great big, bloody great big book. I mean, I've got, yeah, what's Scotland's future?
Yeah.
That's the white paper. Yeah.
Whereas there obviously was not a white paper because, well, I think basically so many of the things around the referendum, both its outcome, its conduct, the trajectory, then I think it set us to a particularly poor version of Brexit, all come back to the original sin of the fact that David Cameron believed that he would be better off winning it quickly in 2016.
Bosh it off, yeah.
Yeah, rather than having a long run-up, up to the point which meant that there was never really a pro-referendum campaign in Wales, because politicians basically went from immediately going, right, so we've got our oh, yeah, we've got Welsh Assembly elections. Oh, right, now we're in the referendum campaign. Oh, wait, now Wales has voted to leave. Now, I am, to be honest, deeply unconvinced that a better run referendum campaign would have changed the actual electoral outcome. But we certainly wouldn't then have been in this position where a year later people can go, I think it means going into the EEA. I think it means leaving the customs union. I think it means, you know...
I think another thing that's different and has changed is now 2 years on, we are much better, or Facebook and Google are much more aware of their potential influence and a potential use of adverts on their platform. So both of them suspended, with some restrictions, campaigning. And I was talking to, you know, some of the canvassers who said, oh my God, until they did that, my Facebook feed was just constant. And there were lots of fears about particularly US pro-life groups putting in huge amounts of money. Now, you might say that's fair in the same way that the Yes campaign did loads of, you know, people allied to it, did lots of crowdfunders to get people home to vote. But the fact that all of that advertising was happening, you know, potentially without anyone being able to, without any visibility, this has always been my problem about advertising on Facebook and Google, is the lack of visibility and transparency around it and seeing how much is being spent, who's spending it. And the fact that they did that, I think, not, I don't know if it affected the outcome, because it's always really impossible to say that. And it was a very decisive victory. So I don't think it could have changed that much. But it's certainly in terms of the tenor of the campaign, I think made it a lot better, because you weren't getting randomers basically jabbing their finger in to say the most inflammatory things possible about the slaughter of the unborn, right?
Yeah, I think the thing is, though, with the Brexit referendum and Facebook, and because the fear I have, actually not just in politics, but in general, we are becoming more atomized as a society in terms of how we consume everything, he said on a niche podcast for politically engaged people largely of a centre-left disposition. And that does make account, it makes it, theoretically, the era in which Zach Goldsmith could run around, you know, kind of...
And with his jewellery.
Liberal bits of London going, I love the environment. And everyone go, oh, he seems like a nice guy. And then run around to another bit like, have you noticed Sadiq Khan is a scary Muslim? The fear is, do you end up in a situation in which you can get away with that? Because neither of those messages are ever seen by a shared group of people. But the thing about the Brexit referendum is you did have, in plain sight, the Turks are coming, and out into the world, liberal Brexit. So I don't think the kind of filter bubble problem was real. Yeah, you know, then the Facebook thing was really, because people did that anyway. But I do think it is a good use of referenda, particularly when one of the main governing parties is irrevocably split on the issue. Now, of course, I don't think, and so one of the reasons why I felt very strongly that it would have been a mistake for the Labour Party to match the referendum offer in 2015 is that the Conservative Party was divided about whether or not the EU or participation in the EU was a good thing. Now, although a minority in the Labour Party believes participation in the EU is not a good thing, and obviously that minority is now considerably more influential and powerful within the Labour Party than it was in 2015, ultimately, I don't think parties should hold referenda in which they are certain of what the answer is, right? That's not an appropriate...
Hang on, a minute ago, you said they should do it as like a rubber stamp when they're following popular will.
But they're two slightly different issues, right? Because
if your whole party agrees on something, then you should presumably just, it's easy to just put it in your manifesto and try and win a majority on it.
Yeah, and you just go, well, look, do this. I think the difference between...
Yes, that makes sense to me. Yeah. I get your point. So yeah, it's about whether or not...
Whereas although, obviously, Labour was almost entirely unified on
the
Scottish Parliament.
Oh, yeah. On Brexit, it was only, what, about 12 MPs, really, who were properly leavers.
Yeah, and so I just think...
Plus Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I think if you believe that... Basically, if you believe that something is a central item of your macroeconomic policy, then you don't go, oh, shall we find out whether or not we're going to have to completely rewrite our macroeconomic policy, which is why...
Yes, it's a bit... Shall we find out what Steve thinks about this? And then we can kind of make the rest of our decisions based on that.
It is a bit like kind of the rise of what I think of as kind of concernsism, which is this really effective way of parties avoiding actually making policy decisions, right? So this whole kind of like... Labour obviously does have a major problem in small towns where it's just not doing as well in them. But your immigration policy cannot be, we have a problem in small towns. It has to be, our immigration policy is X and our electoral strategy goes through what we think our immigration policy should be.
Well, that was
because end up with a policy if you just go, well, there are concerns.
Yeah, that's the Miliband years in a nutshell, isn't it? Like, this is a scary issue that people are really worried about, but we don't have really anything to say to you about it. But you are right to be worried about it. So you're going to get the worst of both worlds. Anyway, let's end the podcast by being happy about Irish campaigners and the victory that they've achieved and Irish women who no longer have to travel. And we'll be returning to this subject because, abortion in Northern Ireland is sure to come up again over the summer. And I think there's going to be some movement around the domestic violence bill. So, yeah.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague, Helen Lewis. It's recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. If you've enjoyed the New Statesman podcast, give us some money by going behind our paywall. Just go to subscribe.newstatesman.com, or to be honest, just search subscribe and New Statesman.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.